Aruna's invitation came 2.5 years ago, and mine came 2.5 weeks ago. And you can drive my Jaguar anytime. Also, because this invitation came 2.5 weeks ago, and because I found myself in the last 4 days away from my home on pressing and other business, what I'd like to do this afternoon briefly is to talk a little bit about factories. And I do so in a way, happily, providentially. Aruna's conclusion opens up for me, your moral opens up for me, an opportunity to reflect theologically on the factory as a site of work. And I also want to do this because, or at least present to you or offer you two characterizing contexts for what I have to say. And the first, of course, not surprisingly, is NAFTA. And the second is that film which so many of us have been seeing recently, The Age of Innocence. And The Age of Innocence, I urged my students in Black Theology, my Black Theology course, to see this film and to think about the subtext or what is not shown. What drives the possibilities for that kind of life? Think about the nearly invisible Irish maids of the 19th century who staffed so many houses of the affluent in New York City and so many other places in the East Coast and in the Midwest. Think, I encourage them, that in these 1870s we begin a period in the African American community, or at least in our experience of living in the United States, of lynching, which moves forward almost uninterruptedly until about 1935, so that about every other day from about 1870 to about 1935, someone is lynched every other day. So I asked them to see The Age of Innocence because I thought it was a very important reflection on the meaning of innocence, what is not seen and what is not heard, and what creates the possibilities for what we do see and do here. Now, what I'd like to say in the time allotted me this afternoon is to just talk a little bit about a theology of social transformation, or a political theology. And I think that stories are important as well, because such a theology finds its starting point in the real sufferings and aspirations, the real cultural and social experiences, and the living faith of the marginated women and men who are deemed expendable in mindless pursuit of power, profit, and pleasure. Such a theology would give a mediation, or provide a mediation, of the Christian gospel, which contests or protests against not only vicious and sinful instances of racism, sexism, and economic exploitation in our liberal, democratic, capitalist system of production, but it might address the psychological and affective agonies which suffuse modern living as well. Such a theology of social transformation might learn from the critical historical accounts of the various arrivals and encounters and migrations of the peoples and cultures who simultaneously clash and coalesce, delight and perplex, offend and uplift one another in the realization of the compound complex operations and cooperations, relations and interrelations, values and practices which make up the United States of America. I think such a theology would understand the cultural and social matrix in a very comprehensive way. Now, I want to focus briefly on the factory for the reasons that I indicated, because of, not only because of NAFTA, not that I have a lot to say about NAFTA, but I have a lot to say about the factory and what happens to people in factories, so that we can begin to think about work in a very concrete way. Of course, factory work is not all the kind of work that there is, but it is a form that I want to focus on because I'm beginning to think it's a disappearing form of work in the United States. The factory is an institution of technology, and so it operates in a kind of social order. I want to think of it as a kind of recurrent scheme. And that scheme is created or conditioned by development, by organic development, by psychic development, and by intellectual development. That is to say, organic development depends a great deal on things like caloric nourishment, appropriate caloric nourishment. It depends a lot on prenatal care. It depends a lot on not being exposed to lead poisoning. And in the larger global sense, it depends a good deal on your country not becoming the site of some company's latest creative, productive effort. So the factory, then, is a kind of recurrent scheme conditioned by development, organic and psychic and intellectual. It also is operated because of practical skills that people acquire through their intellectual development. The factory is also an institution which is created by cooperation. We can bring forth the various divisions of labor, roles, and tasks. The factory may or may not malfunction. When factory workers, individual men and women, fail to assume or are prevented from assuming responsibility for those various roles, when they themselves fail to cooperate or are prevented from cooperating in carrying out their various tasks, then the social good of order begins to break down. And the actual effective cooperation, it's that actual effective cooperation of individuals in the factory, which gives rise to at least one component in what we can call a kind of social good of order. Now, when I talk about these various orders, I want to identify a few particular elements which are crucial in a factory. And the first is personal relations. The most effective way, I think, to understand a factory is to pay attention to not simply the particular goods that come out of factories, whether they are cars or cartons or pins or chairs, but rather, I think we can understand how a factory functions or malfunctions by paying attention to the state of personal relations. There's a lot to be learned, I think, by studying factory development in the first part of the 20th century. Here's where we have something called Taylorizing, thanks to someone whose name was Frederick Winslow Taylor, who was a kind of modern efficiency expert, who prepared a kind of set of recommendations for automobile manufacturers, Henry Ford in particular, because they were attempting to increase productivity. Taylorizing a plant meant that, and this is what we do today, that Taylorizing a plant, although we're trying to stop, Taylorizing a plant meant that every worker's task was planned and the manner in which the task was to be performed and the amount of time it required. This contributed to breaking down really the old-style foreman system, where someone hired the worker, knew the worker, and someone whom the worker often held in respect. That person is replaced by the anonymous efficiency expert, the inspector, the gang boss, if you will, or the speed boss. Now, personal relations, in some way, are so important in a factory. Whom you hold in regard, the people whom you work with and whom you trust. And a correlate of personal relations is personal status. What's the personal status of a factory worker? If we conceive the human person as simply an object or a means of labor power, then we've begun to undercut and devalue that which is most important, I think, at least, in any kind of theological system or system of theological anthropology, that is, the human person. If we treat workers as things because we can more easily coordinate things than persons, it's much easier to organize the chairs and the people sitting in them, then people begin to behave in that way. If each worker is interchangeable with every other young, strong, and healthy worker, then the factory system can deal with requirements of skilled or semi-skilled roles and not with persons. The worker then comes into the factory as another line item in the cost of production. And the distinction between the role and the person is introduced, and the worker is beset, I believe, with feelings of worthlessness, self-esteem, and loss of dignity. Faced with this kind of increasing objectification, not to mention economic and social pinching, workers sometimes and their families collapse under alienation and isolation, confusion and bewilderment. Now, some years ago, and this is always fascinating to me, Richard Barnett and his colleague Robert Mueller wrote a book called Global Reach, about 15, 16 years ago now. But in that book, they raised a number of important questions regarding what they called, quote, the Latin Americanization, end of quote, of the United States. They wanted to speak there, among other things, about the workers' loss of personal status by calling attention to two very modern technological innovations in production, which have become quite commonplace. And the first is the technology for conquering distance, containerized shipping and jet air cargo carriers. And the second is a technology for fragmenting the productive process into a variety of component operations that can be performed across the globe at different production sites and then reintegrated into a global product. So quantities of leather covers, yarn, thread, and cement made in the U.S. are shipped or were shipped to Haiti, where local women, at wage rates as low as any in the hemisphere, assembled them into baseballs. This kind of widespread geographic diffusion of production, of the production process, exploits an inexhaustible supply of cheap labor. Multinational corporations, then, have transmuted these workers into increasingly crucial forms of capital. Not only does such piecework alienate the worker from the product, from the whole or a sense of the whole, it alienates the worker from the sense of the dignity and the meaning of work, a sense of one's own work as dignified and as meaningful. Now, let me say something briefly about valuing the human person in the factory. The factory values efficiency, productivity, and profitability. Over the long term, to function otherwise, to deliberately endorse modes of inefficiency, carelessness, and debt, violates the norms of developed practical intelligence. Yet factory workers are not elements of technology. Factory workers are men and women with hopes and dreams and aspirations. They have families. They have lovers and friends and companions. And they seek ways to develop and enhance their own intellectual and creative potential. These men and women read and sometimes write books. They question their lives and their labor, and they seek ways to constitute themselves as attentive, inquiring, intelligent, reasonable, responsible, and loving human persons. And so they also seek to create and to constitute a society. Workers yearn, I think, for a standard of living which allows them to nourish the mind and the spirit in dignity. They desire an ordering of the workplace in such a way that their persons are honored. And this disregard has been endemic in the factory. Now, there are a number of stories I could share with you as well, which are equally, I think, as painful as the story which Aruna shared with us. These are stories of workers in factories. And we may be able to I think, say that some of this has changed, but I think for too many people, it really hasn't. Let me just share with you a couple of stories which come out of our labor history in the United States. Mamie Williams was a 51-year-old black woman who worked for Chrysler for over 26 years. Diagnosed with a dangerous blood pressure condition, she had been ordered by her doctors to stay at home. Chrysler, however, sent her a telegram telling her to return to work or be fired and lose all the benefits she had accumulated in almost 30 years of employment. An intimidated Mamie Williams returned to her job on the first shift in Department 80. And 1 week later, she passed out on the line and died shortly after being taken home. There's also Rose Logan, a black woman who worked in the Eldon plant in Detroit. She worked as a janitor. Logan had been struck in the plant by an improperly loaded jitney whose driver's vision was obscured. Chrysler's doctors countermanded Logan's own physician's order to stay at home and off her feet. Fearful of losing her job, Logan returned to work, developed thrombophlebitis in her leg, and died. John Taylor, who was a white worker, tells this story. He says, "I worked on what they called a modern grinder. We used to laugh about it because there was nothing modern about it at all. It was ancient. We had to burn off the rough edges of Rangers, which looked like donuts with metal teeth. This part went into the differential. There was a lot of fine dust generated by this grinding. The company put vents on the machines to hold this down, but every shift the filters would get clogged. The supervisor would never give us the little time needed for someone to come and do some maintenance on them. I requested a mask. I got this thing that didn't look right and asked for the box it came in. It turned out to be for paint and gas fumes and was no help against dust. I ran all this down to the union steward, but he refused to deal with it." Is it any wonder, then, that workers, especially men and women of color, see themselves as held in contempt by society? And is it any wonder that workers often despise and abuse themselves and each other? That these men and women suffer physical and psychological disabilities, that their families suffer as well? Is it any wonder that resentment poisons the minds and hearts of so many men and women who work in our factories? Is such disregard and exploitation necessary in the workplace at all? Again, while a factory cannot be operated at a loss, surely it can operate more humanely. And it is futile, as we recognize, to badger the industrialist, to badger the chief operating officer or manager with vague moral precepts which merely censure greed. For any moral appeal to be effective, it must be appraised in the light of sound economic principles which address the concrete situation, and it must provide some decisions for change, both on the short and long term. What is called for, then, is not some mere patching and manipulative rearranging, but concrete change, which is the product of thorough, rigorous and detached study and evaluation. Yet real progress, indeed progress of society and history, can never be realized only through the concrete transformations of economic and political life. Most fundamentally, what is required is the authentic development of these intellectual, psychic, and moral capacities of women and men to meet and protest against decline. There is no substitute, then, for the development of intelligent and responsibly intelligent acting women and men. And in the search for the right way to live, there is no substitute for the cultivation of virtuous women and men who are able to reflect upon and to criticize human life and society, who desire and seek the good, who choose wisely, who act justly, who love mercy, and who walk humbly with God. It seems to me as well that these reflections, brief as they are of mine, on personal relations and on the status of human persons in the factory, attempts to remind us really that being human is more than being a bundle of desires, and that there is much more to life than mere consumption. Indeed, we can be critical of unions themselves and their regressive tendencies in the contemporary period. Workers sometimes feel that industrial society has left them with the dull and hard and dirty jobs and doesn't care. Union officials themselves are aware that the humanization of work opens up issues of not only industrial relations, but deeper and more important issues, issues about human life and human dignity. When these unions fail to perceive that collective bargaining is really about human dignity, when they fail to perceive that collective bargaining is really about a standard of living which perceives, which preserves, enhances, and realizes instances of real value, then I think they betray the men and women whom they insist they represent. Let me repeat, being human is more than being a bundle of desires. There is much more to human life than mere consumption. Let me just conclude with what I think are some questions which any theology of social transformation can begin to reflect on in light of our concern about factories and about unions. Do I know what it is that I am making of myself in my daily choices and refusals? And do I understand that my own liberty and freedom is a very fragile and delicate orienting of my life for eternal life? And do I really know what it means to respect others and to love them? And do I know what it means to be a human person? Indeed, under what sort of cultural and social conditions can human beings be truly and fully human persons? And as I strive to answer that question, do I sufficiently grasp that the conditions for human flourishing are the results of acts of human decision, creativity, and choice? Do I sufficiently grasp that the conditions for that flourishing are really not something simply out there, but they are really something in here? What is the concrete meaning and expression of liberation and of emancipation, of redemption? Do I know what it means to promote intelligent and authentic progress? Do I know what it means to suffer? And do I know that I can be the kind of victim who is capable of victimizing others? Do I know what it means for women and men of different races and ethnic cultural heritages, of different social classes and economic backgrounds, of different educational tastes, to live together? And do I know what solidarity means? Do I know the cost of solidarity? Do I know what it means to live and to value, to love in the presence of God? It seems to me that these questions and the answers that we struggle with give us an opportunity to expose the poverty as well as the potential of our human efforts and solutions to meet up with the breakdowns in the factory, which theologians might translate as the problem of evil. These questions and their answers can help us to think more theologically, politically, about ideological conflict. They can help us to remember that a just society is certainly contingent. It is not necessary. But it does depend upon us, upon just women and men who so live that the truth, intelligibility, and goodness and the beauty of a truly good and human order is radiant. Thank you.